KTOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The seven personal stories you are about to hear were told on April 2nd at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was
Deception.
Music was performed by the Woolpullers. We could kill it all. Siddons grew up in the suburbs of Jacksonville, Florida, where he always dreamed of experiencing the change of seasons, mountains, and never getting a real job. He first visited Alaska in 2008, and since then spent two summers in the southeast, one summer in Katmai National Park. I met him just before that summer, which was last summer, on a ferry between Sitka and Juneau, where he had a couple of days in Juneau before his summer gig in Katmai. On a drive out to run at Eagle Beach, the Taylor Swift song, "We are never, ever, ever getting back together," was on the radio, and he butt-dialed his girlfriend, who had the pleasure of listening to her boyfriend and a random girl trying to sing along. It was clear he was a solid guy when he returned the confused response with the call stating that even if they had somehow broken up, they could definitely get back together. Always on the move, he lived out of a backpack, jumping from boat to boat for years after college before settling on the coast of Maine, where he now resides. Please welcome to the stage, Stu Siddons.
Woo! 207.
This town is way bigger than I thought it was. There's a lot of you. So for the last 10 years, I've sort of been trying to deprogram myself from a lot of the suburban skills that I picked up in those southern ideals. So I did move to Maine about 10 years ago, and it's great. My family, they still live in Florida, which means that I end up spending a little more time there than I really wish I did. I've sort of attempted to get as much of those New England ideals and attitude that I can. The drinking, the long winters, the pride of those long winters, and the honesty. I've really gotten a nice stronghold on that, which doesn't really set well with everything that's going on and the way things are in the South, especially in a conservative city like Jacksonville, where I grew up. And, but every year I venture down there and, I go for my, you know, quote, Christmas vacation, which is more filled with, obligation and awkwardness. There's generally a lot of eye rolling. And I don't necessarily have the best attitude about it. It requires a lot of tact. It requires a lot of patience. Two things that I am very short on. But I still go every year, and the visits seem to get shorter and shorter. Despite that, my attitude doesn't really seem to change towards them. I think I've changed quite a bit since I moved away 10 years ago, but that I'm generally proven wrong each year. And so this last year I was determined to make it a different visit. And, my dad, comes usually to pick me up at the airport. And this year his Prius shows up, probably the only Prius that's stickered with pro-life and, Mitt Romney stickers in America. They still haven't figured out what's going on down there yet. But this year, instead of just my dad picking me up, it's my mom and my sister are there too, and they get out and they hug me. And my mom goes, "Hey, we're going to go visit your grandmother before Christmas, just to get it out of the way. We won't have to see her again the whole time you're here." Which she actually puts up with a lot. My grandmother isn't an easy lady to work with, and she lives in one of those really big retirement homes that you think of when you think of Florida, and Florida's sort of unofficial motto of like Florida, where people go to die. So we get there, and I'm hanging out. I'm having a private conversation with my sister in one corner of the living room. And we're talking about what's happening here tonight. I'm telling her what my future travels are, and that I'm coming here, and I'm going to tell a story. And I realize that it's not just her ears that are hearing this. It's my mom and my dad and my grandmother. And they just berate me with questions. It turns into quite the interrogation. It ends with the question that my mom posed to me, which she goes, "Are you just here to tell that story because you like to hear yourself speak?" And then my sister really quickly, she goes, she has a quick follow-up. She goes, "Does this involve some sort of girl or something?" I'm not going to comment on that part. And we end up transitioning from an interview to story time, and they begin like a downpour of stories of deception about ways that I have deceived them. And there was a lot of them. Some I was proud of. For example, I told my sister the sophomore dance that it was costume themed when actually it was semi-formal. Another story was my mom shared that one time I told her I was going to spend the night at my friend Ryan's house, but I actually spent the night at a girl's house, and I got caught. But she was very quick to point out that as a mother, your offspring cannot deceive. And she knew all along. And this continues on for a little while, and it turns into this flogging of like my family betrayal. That's distracting. And what it starts to maybe realize was that so much of the betrayal that had happened from when I was a teenager, that, you know, I hadn't really moved on from it as much as I had thought, that every year I go back to Florida and I visit this teenager, this person that I was 10 years ago. And to my parents, that's who I still am, because I moved away and I don't see them that often. And those are the memories that we have in common. And so when I move back, or when I go back for Christmas break every year, we just jump right back into the same routine. I have to ask to use the car. I still roll my eyes. My dad still asks me to make my bed in the morning. And what I realized was just that I hadn't really moved on, that the real deception was that as much as I thought I had left behind that person that I was so struggling to leave and to change, that person was always going to be a part of me, and it was always going to be down in Florida. As long as my parents are there, or it's probably as long as I have a relationship with them, I'm still going to revert right back into that, as sad as it is. Thank you.
Katie Giorgio is our next speaker. You may have spotted Katie around town since she moved here from Boston in 2012. Perhaps you've seen her out and about recently with Butters, the border collie puppy. She keeps busy playing trombone in various groups around town, and she's also the bunny queen of the Juno Bunny Bar Hop, which is just around the corner, by the way. Does anybody know what that means? Katie is in love with Juno and intends to call it home for the rest of her life. She spends her days working for the state and moonlights as a trip leader for wilderness volunteers. She's also currently enrolled in the Masters of Public Administration program at UAS. Her story tonight is for your entertainment, but also will be ultimately a confession to her parents, John and Mary. She doesn't think they ever figured out the mystery of the dead snake in their car. Here's Katie.
When I was younger, I had this boyfriend named Chef. And Chef was one of those boyfriends that your parents hope their daughter never brings home. He had tons of tattoos and piercings, and he smoked, and he drank, and he did drugs. And he didn't have a real job. I met Chef in Boston shortly after he had moved there from New York. And he had taken the Feng Hua Chinatown bus up from New York when he moved, and he brought pretty much what he could carry with him on the bus. So we get together, and after a little while, we decide to make a trip down to Staten Island to his parents' house, where the rest of his stuff is. And at the time, I was driving a Toyota Camry, didn't have a ton of space in it. And so I call up dear old mom and dad, and I said, hey, Chef and I are going to go down to New York for the weekend and get his stuff. Do you mind if we borrow your car, which was a larger SUV with fold-down seats, you know, the whole nine yards? And I think mom and dad were a little hesitant to say yes because Chef was involved, but they trusted me completely, so they said yes. So off we go down to New York and in my parents' car. And we load up all of Chef's stuff, and it's like clothes and books and just general crap, and his three pet snakes. And I'm not a snake person at all, but I have to say, so he had two of these, like, some sort of python, and they lived in this tank together, and you could look at them, and they would sort of slither around in this tank, and the live rat feedings were a little outside my comfort zone. But, you know, they actually weren't the worst pet in the world. The worst pet in the world was the third snake, which was this exotic, I think, African sand snake, and it lived in this separate tank with all this sand. It needed a heat lamp all the time, and it never came out from under the sand. It would just stay hidden, and so you couldn't even look at it. So I really didn't understand the point of having such a pet that you couldn't even see. So Chef was a little bit concerned about getting all three snakes back to Boston, okay, because it was February and it was cold. So his solution was to put the two pythons into a pillow sack, and he put the sand snake into a smaller container with sand and everything, and he put the all three snakes under his feet in the car, and we put the, you know, the foot heaters on full blast. And so we drive like 4 hours back to Boston, and we get to his place and unload the car, you know, really quickly. We get the snakes inside first because it's cold out, and the rest of the stuff, and then I take off and go home for the night. And a few hours later, I'm warm in bed, and the phone rings, and it's Chef. And he says, hey, the sand snake, it's not in the container. I don't know where it is or when it got out. You need to go out and check the car. So this is the same time that Snakes on a Plane came out. And, yeah, and I'm out in the middle of the night on the street crawling around my parents' car with a flashlight looking for this snake, which may or may not be in there. And I didn't look very hard. And I call Jeff back, and I say, hey, man, I couldn't find the snake. I'm really sorry. Even if it's out there, it's a goner. It's like 10 degrees out. So I return the car to my parents, and because I really didn't know where the snake was, I chose not to tell them. Because, you know, what do you say? There may or may not be a snake in your car, Mom and Dad. And so, like, a week goes by, and I go out to see my parents, and I take the train out. My mom comes to pick me up at the train station in the car that we had borrowed, and I've largely forgotten about the snake at this point. And so I go to open the door, and this death smell comes out of the car. And it takes me a minute because I've forgotten, and then, ding, snake. but I've already sort of chosen my path, so I say, gee, Mom, what's that smell? And
poor mom and dad, they didn't know where it was coming from at that point. And she said, you know, we guess something died in the car. And we get in the car and we go for a few minutes and the heat kicks on and then the smell starts coming out. And oh, wow, gee, that's awful. So a little bit after that, they took the car to the mechanic and they ended up taking apart the entire dashboard. And lo and behold, there's a snake carcass in there. And so my parents call me because they know that Chef has snakes. They know that we had borrowed the car. And, oh, by the way, my parents are lawyers. They're pretty smart. So they call me up. Hey, we found a snake in the car. Is it Chef's? And, again, I've already chosen my path on this one. Yeah, Chef has snakes, but you know, they're fine in his apartment. I don't know about that snake in your car. And again, you know, my parents are smart people, and I felt really bad about lying to them. And you'd actually think that, you know, the jig is up for me. But my saving grace was they took a picture of the remnants of the snake, and they brought it to work at the law firm. And there was another person there who looked at the picture and apparently said and assured my parents it was a very common, you know, variety Massachusetts native snake. And there, you know, there's no way that it was anything exotic or whatever. So I guess I got off the hook on that one. The only problem is for like the last 10 years, I've felt incredibly bad about lying to my parents about the whole thing. So like it was said in the introduction, this definitely was a story for your entertainment, but I really just want to take a moment right now to say to my parents, who will listen to this recording, I think, in a couple of weeks, Mom and Dad, this is Katie. We're responsible for the dead snake in your car. I'm really sorry. Forgive me.
Our next speaker is Alex Kotlars. He's 23, from Seattle, lived in Juneau for 5 years. You will probably recognize him from playing on stage, singing about a girl named Billy and how the kid is not his son. Some of you got it. Alex loves to disc golf, party, and hang out with his cat named Allie. Please welcome Alex.
How you guys doing? Right on. So, I was born in Norfolk, Virginia, and had a very weird childhood. My dad was a trickster. Yes, this is all about him. He's a wonderful, wonderful father. He liked to tell me little lies when I was a kid, and it took me a really long time to figure out what I was going to talk about, because deception is a big thing that I've been studying for the last year, because we are the wool pullers. Pulling them all over the eyes, you know, the whole thing. But my dad, as far as it came to deception in a funny way, my dad was pretty good at it. My dad liked to smoke pot. He smoked a lot of pot. And he would smoke pot inside. And, you know, me being like 6 or 7, I would walk in and I'd be like, "What's that smell? Like, Dad, what is it?" And he's like, "Well, son, there's a clove sometimes in a cigarette when you get halfway down. And when I hit the cigarette in that certain part, it burns that clove, and that's what makes that smell." Well, was I in a surprise when I turned 13 and I finally smoked pot? It's pretty awesome. I called my dad, and I'm like, I didn't even say anything. I'm like, "Dad, are you serious? Like, really? A clove?" And as soon, he just stopped and he started laughing, like, he was just going off. And he's like, "You believe that?" And I was like, "Yeah, well, I didn't know. I don't know what pot smells like." And so, yeah. So that was one. Another one was, when I was younger, we had a hurricane. This was probably like 2 years after this whole clothes incident. But we had a hurricane. And it was Hurricane Elizabeth, and the power was out for like 3 weeks, right? Unbelievable. one night, him and his friend were hanging out, and out of nowhere, we hear this big scream out in the back, and it was like it sounded like a girl, but it was a guy. I found out in the long run, and so my dad comes rushing into the living room, and he's like, "You guys need to go in your bedroom. Somebody's trying to break into the house right now, and he's gonna get you." And so I'm like, "Oh snap! Like, holy crap! Okay." So me and my brother run into our bedroom, and he's like, "Okay, don't say a single word. You know, just you got to be quiet, otherwise bad things are going to happen." So we go into the room, and then I hear my dad go, like, sounded like, it didn't even sound like a scream, but me being 8, like, I didn't know. All I knew is my dad looked serious, which was half of his deception. But I hear another scream, and then I hear, "Open the door now." And me not thinking, I'm like, "Okay." And I'm like, and that's all I said. I didn't even open the door. I was just like, "Okay." And he's like, "Open the door now. Open the door now. It's your father." And I opened the door, and I'm like, "Why'd you do that?" And I was like, I was about to cry. I was so scared. But, yeah, my dad liked to play a lot of tricks on me. Those were just a lot of few ones. He was mean. He was a mean guy. He told me that if I drank too much Tang, my pubes would turn orange. I'm not even kidding. And me being at that age, not even really having any pubes, it's kind of, it was weird. So I was like, I could drink all the Tang I want right now, but when I get pubes, you know, I guess that's what will happen. There was one. And then, my sister actually, she used to wear leggings all the time. And, we were sitting at the kitchen table and we heard this really big fart. And so my grandma decided to play a trick on her and was like, "Don't fart when you wear leggings because they'll blow up like big balloons and everyone will know what you did." And so from that point on, she never wore leggings again. I used to tell my brother that he was a pony person because you know how like ponies, they don't get any bigger. He believed that one for a while. It's pretty awesome. Oh. My dad also told me that if I wet the bed, the monster living underneath it would drown. Thank you very much.
Karina Torgeson is our next speaker. Karina mostly grew up in Wasilla, so naturally, growing up, she was mostly looking for a way out. She wrote this, not me. When she was 17, she escaped, only returning to Wasilla for the obligatory holiday visits. Her itchy feet led her to many parts of our country. She even tried out a couple of other countries, but she never stayed in one place for very long. Last year, Karina moved back to Alaska and found herself in Juneau, where she fell back in love with this incredible state and thinks, at least for a while, this is where she will call home. Here's Karina.
Last fall, I called home a steel frame and two ever-rotating wheels, and I lived with three lovely young ladies, and we had the views of Central America as our backyard. We were on a bicycle tour, and we had our lives packed into only 4 panniers each, and panniers are bike bags that attach to your bike. You know, when we yearned for this life of no commitment, and we lusted for the unfamiliar and the uncomfortable and some adventure, and we definitely got what we asked for. I often found myself just grinning stupidly and dancing on my bike because I was just so happy, and I would point at the volcanoes in the distance and the goats and the cows in the street and all of the dogs, and we would wave at people and they would wave back, and children would race me, and all of my senses were engaged as I just pumped my legs to turn those two orbs beneath me. You know, and we would just drip sweat as we went up a challenging hill, and we would howl as we went back down the other side. And it was incredible. and, you know, we, We met so many amazing and generous people, and we danced, and we shared stories, and we climbed volcanoes, and we challenged ourselves to learn the language of those around us. You know, we jumped in rivers, and we swam in bioluminescent seas, and we started each and every day not even knowing where we would sleep that night. But that was pretty key, finding a safe place to sleep. So every day we would start really early, and we'd stop biking by about noon, mostly to escape the heat of the day, but also to kind of establish ourselves. And often, you know, we would stay and we would seek out secure places to sleep. And so we would stay in firehouses, schools, Red Crosses, the occasional church, and oftentimes just people, loving people, taking us into their homes. And we were so blown away by the complete generosity of strangers, and it was incredible. But we didn't want to be naive, and whereas we trusted our gut feelings on a lot of these strangers, we had our guards up to most. And we didn't really let out unnecessary information, and most of the time just with the catcalling and just kind of any indecency, we would just ignore those folks. And about halfway through our tour, we found ourselves in the eco-tourism destination of Costa Rica, and it really is just as beautiful as you've ever heard, and there's just wildlife thriving and so abundant, and there's monkeys, and there's sloths, and there's snakes and tarantulas and scorpions. But this is also the first country we saw familiar cultures. You know, we saw a leisure and recreation culture, which is something we didn't see before. We saw people walking their dogs, runners, skateboarders. We saw a culture of fashion and of shopping. We saw these aspects of life as we knew it back in the States, and it kind of created this sense of comfort a little bit. We kind of felt like we were on a vacation from our vacation. And we started to let our guards down just a slightly. And about this time, we had split up. So there was four of us total, and Sammy and Marielle headed west towards the Nicoya Peninsula, and Lana and I headed south towards Hako. And on one particular day, after biking about 50 kilometers, Lana and I, well, she was ready to call it a day. So we rolled into the nearest town, and it's called Caldera. And we, you know, we started our routine, and we were looking for a safe place to sleep, and there weren't many options, but there was an elementary school. So we approached the elementary school, and we find the director, and she's awesome, and we are chatting with her, and things are going really well, and we're meeting her students. So we ask if we can pitch our tent behind her fence in her schoolyard. And she kindly lets us know that we can't do that. But she suggests that we camp on the beach. Now, this is something we've been anticipating our whole trip, finally camping outside, somewhere in the wild, without a fence, away from towns and people. But this didn't really seem like the place, because we were still in a town, and we were pretty exposed. But we had talked to other cyclists who had said that they camped all over beaches in Costa Rica, and, you know, that, with this suggestion from a school principal, we decided to maybe just give it a try. So we went around town asking more folks, and we received the same positive encouragement. Absolutely, it's safe. People camp here all the time. So we headed to the beach, and we started making dinner, and we were kind of just lazing around in the sun and playing in the waves with other young families and couples. And later in the evening, this older gentleman approached us who works at the beach, and, you know, he asked if we were planning on sleeping there. We got a little nervous because it was getting late, and we thought he might kick us out. But his smile only grew, and he got really excited, and he told us of all of the people that had camped right in this spot from all over the world, from Argentina, Colombia, from Canada. And his excitement was just so contagious that we felt pretty solid in our decision to finally camp. And so, you know, as the night grew and the stars started to light up the sky, we set up our tent and we situated our tired bodies, and we fell asleep. And I woke up screaming. I woke up to strange men entering our tent, reaching for Lana's hand. I woke up and I screamed because I needed somebody to hear. I woke up and I screamed because I didn't know what was at stake. My life, my friend's life, my body, her body. I screamed to scare these monsters away. And I screamed because it was my weapon. And then I saw his gun, and I stopped screaming. And, you know, I can't really tell you how, but almost immediately that fear of the unknown went away because it became obvious they only wanted our material possessions. And he had a gun rested on Lana's temple. So they win. And at one point, the man in our tent, and there had to have been at least three or four more outside, but his head was turned, and so I tried to rummage my passport out of my bag. And he caught me, and he demanded it. Plata, dinero, dame, dame tu dinero, tarjeta también. I just remember him demanding our money. So I hand him my bag, and I'm pleading for my passport. And he tosses it outside, and he looks at his friend, and he's saying something. And then he turns back to us, and right at this point, there's almost a pause in the commotion, and the silence grows. And he takes his gun from Lana's temple, and he puts it on her forehead. Boom. He whispers, and he snickers. And then my passport flies back in the tent on my face. Like really generous thieves, right? They gave me my passport back. But, you know, and at this point, the man in our tent, he withdraws his gun, and he cradles it in his hands, and he places it on his cheek, indicating that we go back to sleep. Dormi. Si no duermas, disparo. Si te vas, disparo. Sleep. If you don't sleep...
You're listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event on KTOO News Juno.
And then they were gone.
These stories were recorded on April 2nd, 2014 at the Northern Light United Church.
Completely unharmed.
The theme for the evening
was... But there we were with
this deception.
Recognition that
curious?
Our decisions
www.mudrooms.org.
And I can't even begin to tell you how grateful and lucky we felt to come out of the situation the way that we did. But... You know, we had a gut feeling, we didn't listen to it, and we did things differently than our norm. We had kind of deceived ourselves. But after leaving the tent and after things calmed down, I noticed that my bike was still locked to a tree, and I had one pannier. They didn't get away with everything. And that one had my spare parts and my repair kit. And so I reunited with Sammy and Marielle, and I was much lighter than before, but I had my guard back up and fully erect. And I found myself back on the road.
Overseas, moving around a lot. He is the father of two. His soon-to-be doctor son lives and works in Victoria, B.C. Mike's daughter, who has followed her father's footsteps and works in the radio industry, is in the process of moving to Los Angeles. Mike moved to Juneau 15 years ago with the plan of staying for 1 year, and he just never left. Up until a year and a half ago, he worked for KINY Radio and went by the name of Mike Lane. Now he owns and operates a small video and audio production company, Audio Borealis Production. Mike recently married 7 months ago. Woo! And is planning, I'm going to Panama in October for his honeymoon. Done. Mike.
Oh, that was a long intro, huh? I didn't realize I wrote that much in that email when she asked me to say a little something about myself. So, yeah, I've lived in Juneau for 15 years, which is longer than I've lived anywhere, ever, by a long shot. I've always had nomadic tendencies and moved around a lot my entire life. See, when I was a kid, I was told that my dad worked for Exxon. I don't know what he did for Exxon, just that he worked for them. And we lived all over the world. We lived in England, Greece, Saudi Arabia, most notably was Libya in North Africa, in a small village called Marseille Brega. Now, Brega was, to say it was surrounded by nothing would be an understatement. The Sahara everywhere and the Mediterranean to the north. I'm shaking like a leaf, so I'm going to lean on something. Yeah, I haven't been in front of this many people in a long time, so I got to kind of steady myself. At any rate, like I said, I was told that my dad worked for Exxon, and I don't know what he did. And we did live everywhere. And while we were in Brega, he was, well, I was told, he was working at a refinery there. And I didn't really understand what he did at the refinery. Now, I wasn't told the entire story. I was told part of the story. That's how deception works, is you get a small portion of the story, and then you get the rest of it later, right? Well, well, we lived there until 1981. That's when my mother and I were evacuated. We were in a military evacuation and sent to England. My dad had to stay in Libya and work at the refinery, so I was told. Yeah. Well, December 1st, 1981, the phone at the hotel room rang, and my mother answered, and it was a friend of the family. He ordered my mother to gather me and get on the next flight to Jamaica. So we did. Well, we were in Miami waiting for a connection to go to Ochos Rios, and I noticed a very thin man sleeping in the chair across from us at the airport. He was dirty, full beard, arms crossed. And it was my dad. I hadn't seen him in 4.5 months. And I didn't believe it was him at first. I had to really inspect him to make sure it was him, because I hadn't seen a man this thin before. He looked like he hadn't showered or eaten in weeks. I pointed him out to my mom. She didn't believe me. She said, "No, that's not your dad." I said, "No, it's him." Well, she got a closer look. Definitely it was him. So after the tears and the hugs, we all boarded a flight to Jamaica. Like I said, we stayed in Ochos Rios until Christmas Day that year. That's when the phone rang again. My dad had orders to be back in the Middle East. I thought this was odd for an oil man. I never asked anything about it, though, really. Well, my dad retired years later and didn't speak of his work. And this was our life, really, while he was working. Is we just moved everywhere. I didn't know where we were going to be next or when we were going or what he did for a living, really. So like I said, he retired, and he didn't speak of it until years later, about 3 years ago, in fact. He got a call from Washington, D.C. He was asked to be a docent at the B reactor in Hanford. Now, the B reactor, if you don't know about it, it's the largest or the first large-scale nuclear reactor built to produce plutonium-239 for the Manhattan Project. And I asked him, I said, "Well, why did they choose you to be a docent there?" He said, "Well, I worked there once." That's all he said. He didn't say anything else about it until about 6 months ago. He was on his deathbed. And I sat with him and I asked him, "Tell me that story again." He said, "Well, it turns out my dad was one of the last three living people who worked at B Reactor." He told me that he became a nuclear engineer there and joined the Navy. And I said, "Well, how'd you go from that to Exxon?" He says, "Well, we didn't really. We moved all over the world under the cover of Exxon and Standard Oil. And the facilities that he worked in, he told me, were disguised inside of oil refineries so that those people didn't really understand what was going on there. He said it was more work to keep people oblivious to the work they were doing than it was to actually do the work. So we went all over the world to countries that Europe and the U.S. had concerns about nuclear activity and capabilities. And that was the entire story there. Well, this whole story that my dad told me just days before he died explained a lot about my nomadic tendencies. I learned a lot about him in a very short period of time. More about him and myself in just a few days than I had learned in 46 years. I learned that my childhood, while I was growing up, was really a ruse. It was deception at its best. I wasn't given the whole story. I didn't know he worked in the nuclear field. I thought he worked for Exxon. I thought he worked in Brega in Libya, in North Africa. But he didn't. See, my dad would get up Monday mornings and go to work, come home on Fridays. I saw him on weekends only. See, he worked at a facility that was south of Brega, about a 7-hour flight, in a place called Zeltan, out in the middle of the Sahara. And they would only fly in and out once a week. So that's the way I saw him. And now in our house in Brega, I forgot to mention this, we had a very peculiar room. It had three hot water heaters, a workbench, and a bunch of test tubes. It looked like a science lab. I only saw the inside of it one time, and then it was locked, and I wasn't allowed back in. Told never to mention what I saw inside. Well, when I was talking to my dad at his deathbed, I did learn something about him. He's a good old boy from Tennessee. I think you can figure it out. The three hot water heaters, they were a still. Yeah. Everywhere we lived, all around the world, my dad had three hot water heaters that were not making hot water. And I was oblivious to that. He was pretty good at deception, that old man. Thank you.
Kevin Hood is our next speaker. Kevin grew up in California, originally in Los Angeles, and then in the small coastal town of Los Osos. He can remember being kept indoors on smog days and spending hours sitting on the freeway in L.A. traffic, but more vivid and impressionable memories are of his folks taking him and his brother backpacking in the Sierra Nevada mountains throughout their childhood. That instilled within him a deep love of nature that has only grown stronger over time. His partner, son, and daughter share this love as they explore the wild environs around their home in Southeast Alaska.
The Norway story is going to be another time. Sorry. I've worked as a wilderness, in wilderness for almost 19 years now. And in my work, one of the things I do is I talk to the folks out in the wilderness in, you know, groups around campfires, on the trails, sometimes on tour boats here in Southeast Alaska. And people ask me questions. Oh, you work out here. And once in a while, someone will ask me, what's the most amazing thing you've ever seen? And it's a question I've kind of struggled to answer, and my answer has been evolving over time. But originally, my answers all went to the wildlife I had seen in the wilderness. I could tell of one of my first years here in the Endicott Arm when my work colleague said, oh, man, look, someone left a dog on the beach. And I was like, I don't think that's a dog. And we sat down, and the wolves hadn't caught our scent, and there were two of them we could see, one on the water, one at the forest, and the water one had run up to the forest one down to the water, and for almost a quarter mile, they came sweeping the beach this way until they got about 40 feet from us, and then they just stopped and saw us sitting there, and they were just looking at us, going, woof, seeing if we'd move, and then suddenly about 20 feet away, I heard a woof. And there were two more over here I hadn't even seen. And that was a pretty amazing. And I got to see that green fire Aldo Leopold once described so eloquently. But that wasn't quite what I'd say is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And there was another time when I was out sea kayaking, and my partner and I would hear the this kind of the quick inhalation, exhalation of the orcas. But we couldn't see them. We're going, God, where are they? We know they're close. We can hear them. But they were blending in perfectly. There are three of them. And two of them came and swam kind of around us. And the middle one came. And it just swam really slowly. I didn't even know they can go this slow. And it just did a total circle around my kayak on its side, looking over at me. I have never felt so small, so fast in my life. I was just like, wow. And I have other wildlife stories. You know, there's a time I was doing yoga in an alpine meadow and a mountain lion walked in Arizona. Or if you spend time in wilderness, these kinds of, you know, there's a lot of dumb ones too, like the chipmunk ate your boot laces and those things. But those aren't amazing. And I've seen bears playing hide and seek on an iceberg that was beached, you know, things like that. But I think the most amazing thing, I was going, that's not quite it. It's something else. And I started thinking about some of the human animals I'd seen in wilderness. Start thinking that's a little closer. I can think of a time when I was working over in Pack Creek. It's a brown bear viewing area, you know, over on Admiralty. And it was like in late August. It's just snotty, you know. It's like you're standing out in a car wash going, man, this, I can't wait to get back to the wall tent. And this plane comes up about 5 in the evening, and three people from India get out. It's a man, his sister, and his wife, and they're wearing flip-flops, jeans, and cotton sweatshirts. And I'm going, wow, you didn't get the briefing, did you? It's just pouring rain. But they came up, and you could tell they were a little nervous. They're walking around. They have to walk, you know, over to where I'm at. And I talked to them about bears. This is what we do at Pat Creek. You tell them, you know, that you're in bear habitat. There are bears here. But you also just explain to them what to do if you see a bear, because I'm not going to be your, I'm not going to go with you everywhere. You're going to be free to go up the trail to the observation tower. And so I told them, you know, just stay together and pretend you're a bigger bear if one comes towards you. And so we watched out in the spit and looked around for a while, and there was some far off, but nothing really close. And then they went up the trail, and they were gone for about an hour, and it was really almost dark when they came back, and their plane had come, and they were just waiting. And I finally saw them, and it was pouring rain, and they were totally soaked, totally cold, but they didn't even know it, because when they came back, they were glowing. I could feel them. I could feel the, you know, just, they're radiating. And they said, "We did it! We did it!" And I said, "You did what?" "No, we saw a bear, and we did just what you said." And they told me how they're on the trail, and a bear had come down about 30 feet in front of them, and it had come toward them, you know, wanted to use the trail. And it actually, they'd all stood together, hey bear, you know, and they all said, "We did what you said. We all pretended we were the bigger bear." And I said, "It worked." And they're like, "Yeah, it came to within 20 feet, and it looked at us, and then it just walked off." And they were so excited. And for these people to come and conquer this fear, because all cultures, no matter where you're from in the world, have this fear of animals long in tooth and claw. And to see that they could just come, be totally, you know, not prepared dress-wise or anything, but have that experience and go away, that was incredibly lifting. Another time in Endicott Arm, we'd had 5 days of complete rain. We actually used the kayak bilge pump to empty our tent in the morning. It's kind of the Southeast experience. And at the end of this time, we're paddling, and it's like there's a wall of black. The storm's finally lifting, and I see this one guy coming. And, you know, it's like 3 miles away, so we're paddling, going, "God, I don't know anybody who's out here. Who's out here?" It's kind of, again, late in the season. And it's this old man. He's not old, I shouldn't say that, but he was retired. I mean, he was, yeah. Can I rewind the tape for a sec and start that? Yeah, no. But there's this guy by himself. And I was like, "Oh, hey, you know, that's amazing. You know, how are you doing?" He's like, "This is fantastic." And I'm going, "Well, why are you out here by yourself?" He's like, "Yeah." And he told us his story. And he had bought a tour. You know, he was going to go on a kayak tour, but they couldn't fill it. And he bought his plane ticket and everything. He was really excited. And they canceled the tour because they couldn't sell enough seats. And he had basically decided to come on his own. And I was like, "Oh, so you've obviously been kayaking a lot. So this is my third time ever in a kayak." And I said, "Well, how's it been? This has been like the greatest rainstorm we've had for a long time." He said, "Oh, this is the best thing I have ever done." And I could just feel him. He's like trembling when he says that. And I realized this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It's the human animal returning to its wildlife roots when they go back home to wilderness, such that they can just feel fully alive. That's the most amazing thing I have ever seen. Thank you.
Our last speaker tonight is Bridget Smith. Bridget Smith is a writer who came to Juneau in 1968 with her mother and sister and felt like a fish out of water for the first year. After that miserable year, she realized that, contrary to her first impressions of Alaska, she had ended up in an earthly paradise. She made many wonderful friends and eventually met and married Jim Asper. They have two daughters, Sarah and Brenna, who also live in Juneau. She feels fortunate indeed to live in a community with such enthusiastic appreciation for the arts and artists. Please welcome to the stage our last speaker tonight, Bridget.
Hi. So it was 1970, and I was 20 years old, and I was on my own, really, for the first time, when I moved to McGrath, which is in the middle of the state, as a student teacher. And I was a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So So McGrath at that time, well, first, McGrath is on the Kuskokwim River, and it's in the interior. It's little, and at that time had about 300 residents. To me, McGrath had it all. It was surrounded by miles of gorgeous country that we could explore with snow machines and airplanes, subsistence culture of hunting and fishing, many rugged individualists. For a single woman, there were more men than women, and three bars for 300 people. So there was wildlife around McGrath, and there was wildlife in the bars at night in McGrath. It was there that I declared my Declaration of Independence. I was going to do everything on my own. I rented a cabin from a woman named Margaret Mespelt, and Margaret became my role model. She had a mom-and-pop gold mining operation, as many people in that area did and still do. So she worked that mine in the summer. And also in the summer, she grew her vegetables. She was self-sufficient. And I would go and I would visit Margaret, and we would drink tea, and I would sit on the couch in her big log house, and my feet would dangle, because every single piece of furniture in Margaret's log house was elevated. And it was elevated because every spring, or almost every spring, the Kuskokwim at breakup overflows its banks and floods the whole village. So instead of taking her furniture up and down, she just left it up all year round. So it was all kind of high. And on the walls of her log house were congressional digests. She would get them, it was frequent, in the mail. And they came from Washington, D.C., and she would read them, and then she would nail them up on the wall because it was insulation. One thing about McGrath that I haven't mentioned is that it's one of the coldest places in the whole state. If you watch the weather, you'll always see that McGrath is always way below zero. That first winter in McGrath, I remember three straight weeks of 68 below zero. It was cold there. I'd never experienced such cold in my life. So I rented this cabin from Margaret, and it was just a little bitty cabin with an outhouse that had a styrofoam seat, because they're always warm. And then I heated it with an oil cook stove. So it was both heat and I also cooked on it. And sometimes when it got really cold, I would open up the oven and I would stick my feet inside of it in order to stay warm. It was cold. My only responsibility was to check the level of fuel in the 55-gallon oil drum that was right outside the cabin. That was my only responsibility. Well, one day, during one of those way, way below zero times, I ran out of oil, and immediately it was cold. So my first thought was, I am an idiot. How could I have done this? And my second thought was, I don't want anybody else to know that I am an idiot. So I unhooked the 55-gallon drum, and I rolled it. See, they don't deliver in McGrath, or at least at that time they didn't. So I rolled it down this snowy trail to the airstrip where they had oil, and I filled it up with oil, and then I tried to roll it back. And, of course, I couldn't. It was too heavy. So I was thinking, what am I going to do? I don't want anyone to know. If anyone has ever lived in a village, everybody knows everybody else's business and will bring it up at the most inappropriate moments. So I did not want to be known as the one who ran out of oil because I hadn't checked the level. So I called a friend, and he had a snow machine. He came. I swore him to absolute secrecy. Got it. And so we put the oil drum on the sled, brought it back, hooked it back up, started the, it started flowing again into the stove. It was warm again. It was wonderful. Now, I learned so many things during that 2 years in McGrath. For one thing, you know, when you're in your early 20s, well, you just learn a lot. Your brain's on fire. And I learned how to butcher a moose. I learned how to bake bread. I learned how to snare a rabbit. I learned how to mourn a friend who had died. I learned how to race a snow machine. I learned how to fly an airplane. I learned how to teach 7th and 8th graders. That's another kind of wildlife. But I realize that everything that I learned from other people, like Margaret. Now, I'm the same age now that Margaret was then, and I've taught younger people how to do things like making blueberry jam, or how to write a good essay, or how to drive a car. And I've come to realize that we survive and thrive because of other people, because of what we learn from other people, because of the support and encouragement we get from other people, because of the communities that we live in. We have this idea that we need to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, but it's a dangerous fallacy. We need other people. So tonight I'm standing here before you and I'm going to make another declaration. And this time it's a declaration of interdependence. Thank you.
News Juno 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on April 2nd, 2014. The theme for the evening was
Deception.
Visit mudrooms.org to tell your story. Audio production by Pat Roach.